Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode until the question and answer portion of today's conference. If you'd like to ask a question at that time, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. This conference is being recorded. If you have any objection, you may disconnect. Now I'll turn the call over to your host, Mr. Joseph Lamb. Thank you, sir, and you may begin.
Thank you, Michelle. And welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Ask the Expert session. Today's topic is Service Integration Bus Scalability Best Practices. My name is Joseph Lam, and this session will give you the opportunity to speak to our panel of experts on a variety of subjects related to today's topic. Moving on to slide number two. In today's session, we will start off by introducing to you our panel of experts for the day. We will then move on to give you a brief introduction to Service Integration Bus Scalability Best Practices. Next, our panel of experts will answer questions that were pre-submitted to us through email. Then, we will open the lines for live Q&A period. And finally, the session will end with a summary of today's webcast. Moving on to slide number three. At this time, I would like to introduce to you our panel of experts for today's call. Our panel consists of Justin Fries, WebSphere Service Integration Technology Support.
Hi, my name is Justin Fries. I've been with IBM for nearly 14 years, most of it working on WebSphere MQ, but in more recent years, working on the Service Integration Bus.
Good morning. My name is Belinda Fuller. And I have been working within the IBM organization in various roles over the past 14 years, most recently working within WebSphere MQ and the Service Integration Bus.
Hi, my name is Tim McCormick. I joined the company about 3 years ago, most of which I've spent in the SI Bus Level 3 role.
Good morning. Rich Montjoy. I've been with IBM for 16 years. Most of that has been with WebSphere MQ and been with the Service Integration Bus since the V6 release.
Good day, everyone. My name is Mohammed Naji, and I've been with IBM for the past 8 years. I worked on WebSphere MQ for the past 6 years and SIB for the last 2 years.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ty Schrake. I've been with IBM for about 16 years, and most of that was with WebSphere MQ Level 2 support. And more recently, for the last 6 years or so, with Service Integration Bus Level 2 support.
Hello, everyone. My name is Paul Slater, and I've worked with IBM for the past 8 years. I've worked on various products in this time, including WebSphere MQ, WebSphere Message Broker, and WebSphere Application Server. I'm currently working in the SIB Level 3 team.
My name is Andrew Whitfield. I've been working for IBM for 8 years. I've been working in the SI Bus development and Level 3 organization for the last 4 years.
Thank you. Now, before we get to the question and answer period, our panel would like to give you a technical overview of the topic. Moving on to slide number four, and please go ahead, Mohammed.
Thank you, Joseph. Introduction. The Service Integration Bus, SIB or just SIB, which is an implementation of the WebSphere Application Server default messaging provider since version 6 of WAS. It has proved its ability to handle growing amount of messaging work in a graceful manner. That said, SIB decisively provides the underpinning of a number of IBM products, notably the WebSphere Process Server, WebSphere Portal, Maximo Asset Management, and there are a few others like WebSphere Enterprise Server Bus. SIB implementation in these products supports not only fast internal JMS messaging, but also the use of mediation, that is format and protocol transformation of message flow. Mediations are not the subject of today's presentation. Today's topic is on the SIB best practices that meet the demands of such scalable environments. We will start off by answering a set of predefined, most common questions regarding SIB scalability, and you will then have the opportunity to ask questions in this matter. Moving to slide five, please. Question number one. Before we delve into the realm of SIL scalability and its best practices, it is important to understand what remote gets and remote puts are. So question number one, what are remote puts and remote gets? Moving to slide 6, please. SIL terminology. There are a couple of abbreviations and terms that will heavily be used throughout this presentation. For instance, messaging engine, or just ME. This is a lightweight runtime component of SIB. It runs inside the JVM, app server process. It is the core processor of SIB in that it handles application connections, manages destinations, and processes messages. Q-point, or QP. In SIB, a queue has two representations, a logical representation, which does not hold messages, and a physical representation that actually holds messages. This physical presentation is referred to as a queue point. The queue point is localized in the ME you chose during the bus destination creation wizard. RQP stands for Remote Queue Point. This is a dynamically created queue point. It does not have a logical representation associated with it as the user-created queue point does. As the part of the name remote suggests, it is localized in one ME and acts as a proxy to the destination queue point localized in another ME. In the next three slides, we will shed some light on this type of object and how it is used in SIB. Moving to slide 7, please. Remote queue point. By default, applications don't necessarily connect to the ME where the destination queue point is localized. They can connect to any available ME. When that happens, the ME to which the application is connecting to determines the location of the destination queue point through the workload manager, or just WLM. Once the location is found, the ME creates a remote queue point and uses it to send and receive messages to the destination queue point on behalf of the application. In the next two slides, you will see graphics that illustrate how this is achieved. Moving to slide 8, please. Remote put. The faded diagonal arrow in this and the next graphic simply represents a direct application connection to the ME that localizes the destination queue point, should remote operation be avoided. Here, the remote put operation is implemented by the two connections shown in horizontal and vertical solid red arrows. The producing application attaches to engine 1, sends a message to the queue destination, which has a queue point Raleigh localized on engine 2. The message is queued up on the remote queue point Raleigh on engine 1 before transmission to the queue point on engine 2. In normal circumstances, the message is sent to the queue point Raleigh on engine 2 as soon as possible. If the message is not, it stays in the remote queue point Raleigh on engine 1 until engine 2 confirms that it has received it. Notice here that engine 2 does not have to be running in order for the producing application to send its messages. Moving to slide 9, please. Remote get. Similarly, the remote get operation here is implemented by the two connections shown in horizontal and vertical green arrows. The consuming application attached to engine 3 attempts to consume a message from the queue destination, which has a queue point Raleigh localized on engine 2. Engine 3 sends a message request to the queue point Raleigh on engine 2. When a message that satisfies the criteria of the message request is available at the queue point Raleigh on engine 2, the message is sent to the remote queue point Raleigh on engine 3 to be picked up by the consuming application. Note here that engine 2 must be running in this case, otherwise the application or the operation will fail. Moving to slide 10, please. Pros and cons. Given remote get and remote put definitions, let's analyze their advantages and disadvantages. Well, they both allow transparency of the destination cue point location, but generally speaking, this should not be the main reason to use either one of them. If remote put is intentionally implemented, it is because of its two main advantages. First, unlike remote get, the ME where the destination cue point is localized does not have to be running, thanks to asynchronous message production. Second, it takes advantage of workload management for partitioned queues. More on partitioned queues in this presentation. When a scalable SIB environment is desired, the aforementioned two remote put advantages overcome its obvious additional latency that is due to synchronous request reply. The remote get, on the other hand, has two more interrelated disadvantages. It introduces consumer latency due to multiple message hops. This translates to having multiple points of failure, hence complex diagnosis. To conclude answer to question number one, avoiding remote get would obviously be a best practice advice. I will now handle the mic over to Belinda. She will handle question number two in slide 11.
Thank you, Mohammed. This is Belinda, and I will be answering question number two. Question number two is, what are the best practices for remote connections? Slide number 12, please. Careful planning is the first step to achieving a reliable and stable configuration. This includes understanding the best practices and employing them in your environment. Whenever and wherever possible, configure your system to avoid remote get by connecting directly to the ME that localizes the cue point your application will consume from. The default behavior of applications will be to connect to any available ME in a bus and will always prefer an ME in the same application server if one is available. To override the default behavior, three properties can be set, and they're provided on the connection factories and activation specifications, which allow you to specify target MEs or groups of MEs to use for your connection. Slide number 13, please. Next, I will give an overview of the three properties you can set to control how your application will establish a connection to an ME. The first property is called the target property. This property will contain a name of a specific target, such as a bus member name, an ME name, or the name of a custom group of MEs. The value entered here will correspond to the type of the target specified in the target type property next. Multiple values can also be specified for your targets on that target field by separating your list with commas. The target type property is the next property that has three possible types. The first type is bus member. This type targets MEs in a specific server or cluster. This option will retrieve the active ME hosted by the member named in the target property. Custom messaging engine group is the second option, and this type allows you to define a group of MEs to satisfy the connection requirements. And lastly, the messaging engine. This type targets a specific ME by its actual name. The third property is called the target significance property. It has two possible values. One value is required. If this is set to required and a connection to an ME in the specified target does not succeed for any reason, no connection is established whatsoever. However, if you set the target significance property to preferred, and if this option is selected and the connection in the specified target does not succeed, an attempt then will be made to connect to any available ME in the bus. If you are setting these properties to avoid remote get, set this property to required. Otherwise, remote get could occur if the target MEs are not available. The default value that you should note for this property is preferred. Slide number 14, please. Next, we will talk about provider endpoints. Another property exists on the connection factory and activation specifications that specify the provider endpoints. When you connect your client application to the bus from outside of the cell, provider endpoints need to be specified on the connection factories and activation specifications. These endpoints provide the location of bootstrap servers, which are running the SIB service. Each endpoint comprises of three parts, a host name, port number, and the chain name. Multiple endpoints can be specified by separating each entry by a comma. So this is generally how this particular endpoint will be used by a client. When a client first connects to the bootstrap server, they will select an ME based on the target properties and the connection proximity. If the target ME is running in a different server than the bootstrap server, the client will transparently establish its connection to the target server. Slide number 15, please. Next, we'll talk about basic and secure bootstrap, as there are two options for specifying your endpoints using either basic or bootstrap messaging transports. The bootstrap basic messaging port corresponds to the port assigned to the SIB underscore endpoint underscore address used by the SIB service. If SSL is not enabled, this is the port that is used by the client connection to discover the location of a suitable ME to connect to. The bootstrap secure messaging port corresponds to the port assigned to the SIB endpoint secure address used by the SIB service when SSL is enabled. You determine the port and the transport chain by examining your application server's port information. Additionally, you can check each server to determine if the SIB service is enabled, as seen in the red arrow. The SIB service must be enabled in any server that you specify it as a provider endpoint on your connection factory or activation specification. The screenshot shows the default port numbers used by these two transports. These port numbers will, however, be unique if you have multiple application servers running on the same host. A point to keep in mind is do not use the bootstrap address, as this is not used by the SIB service. It is used for Jindy lookup. Slide 16, please. In the graphic on this slide, we can see that there is a cluster called Cluster A, which consists of two application servers, Server 2 and Server 3, and also has two MEs. The application, though, is located in Server 1 and needs to consume messages from the queue point on Hursley on Server 2, which is localized queue point on the message engine called cluster A.000. When the application on Server 1 tries to connect using the default target properties on the connection factory, the local ME on Server 1 will be used first if it is available, and that is because it is local to the application. Since this is the default behavior, the result is remote get will occur. To override the default behavior in this example, we have set target type, and target significance properties on the connection factory to control which ME the application will connect to. In the target field, we entered the name of the cluster, which is called Cluster A, as the target bus member, which corresponds to the target type we have chosen below. We also set the target significance to required. So now, when the application in Server 1 attempts to create a connection, it will choose the active ME in Cluster A. If no ME is available in Cluster A, no connection is made. So to summarize this best practice, target your activation specifications and connection factories to MEs containing localized queue points to avoid remote get. Slide 17, please, and I now hand the microphone over to Ty Schrake, who will answer question number 3.
Thank you, Belinda. Thanks, everyone, for being here today. I'm going to talk briefly now about scaling producer applications. Let's move to slide 18, please. When we talk about scaling producers, what we're really talking about is how to scale the message load that producers create. It doesn't matter if you have one producer that produces lots of messages or 1,000 producers that produce a modest number of messages per producer. In the end, it's about the message load, and from a messaging system perspective, the main issue is how to configure your messaging system to manage the total message load produced by all producers. And here on this slide are some initial key points. You want to give your producers a latitude when connecting. Producers can connect to any ME, not just the one which localizes a particular destination. And specifically, that refers to remote put. Do not restrict the choice too much with target properties. You can add more messaging engines for high connection loads. often wise to set up a cluster of messaging engines to handle connections and use target properties to connect producers to this cluster, and the connections will be balanced across the messaging engines. The best practice here is add messaging engines to handle very large numbers of connections and rely on remote put to forward messages to their destination. So the basic lesson here is that if you anticipate large message loads, you should add messaging engines to your messaging cluster to handle the load. Let's move to slide 19, please. Now we'll talk briefly about partition queues. Using partition queues is a good strategy when you have many messages being produced to the same queue. Here's why. Sending large numbers of messages to a single queue puts a lot of load on the queue and the messaging engine that hosts that queue. Partitioned queues are queues that are distributed across messaging engines. For example, if you have a queue named QX, this queue will appear on each new messaging engine you add to the messaging cluster. So as you add messaging engines to the cluster, you will add partitions of QX to each new messaging engine, and this is all automatic. This relieves the messaging load from a single queue and a single messaging engine and distributes the load across multiple messaging engines. And reading from the slide now, multiple producers may exceed the capacity of a destination. You've basically got three basic configurations. You've got a server bus member where you have just one queue point. That's where you have a server that's added as a member to the bus without any cluster at all. The second scenario is a cluster bus member with one messaging engine. In that case, you'll have one queue point. And the third scenario is a cluster with multiple messaging engines. In that case, you'll have one queue point per messaging engine. Those are partitions. As you add messaging engines to a cluster, you add queue points. Each queue point is called a partition of the queue, and each partition has the full capacity of a normal queue point. The queue capacity scales linearly with the cluster. So even though we use the term partition, they're not little slices of the queue. Each partition queue has full capacity of any normal queue. So the best practice here is to assign high-volume queues to clusters and add messaging engines to match the queue capacity to your workload. And let's move to slide 20, please. Okay, in addition to partition queues to your system, you can distribute messages across these partition queues. In simplest terms, you can fan out the messages across the partition queues. This is done with workload management. And this is balancing the messages between all of the partitions. Messages will be distributed to all available partitions if the producing application relies on remote put. If the producing application is connected directly to an ME in the cluster, all its messages will go to the local partition. However, in version 7 of WebSphere Application Server, a JMS queue option to distribute the messages to all available partitions, even when there is a local partition, is available to you. So in version 6.1, for example, of WAS, you don't have this option. So even if you have many partitions, if you connect to a messaging engine that has one partition, the messages will go to that partition. But in version 7, even if you connect directly and there's to a messaging engine with a partition, you can set an option so that the messages still get fanned out across all the partitions. And so the best practice is to use remote put or select the new version 7 option, which is called do not prefer a local queue point over other queue points on the JMS queue definition used by the application. And moving to slide 21, please. Okay, this slide provides a graphic representation of a basic workload management scenario where producers connect to the cluster and messaging engines are distributed across partition queue Hursley. And so basically what you have here on the left-hand side is cluster A with servers 1 through 5, each one with four producers on it, all connecting to a different cluster, which is your messaging cluster, cluster B. And you'll notice that in depicted here we see server 6, server 7, and server 10. But all these servers have a queue point named Hursley. These are partitions of the destination Hursley. And each one of these has the full capacity of any normal queue. And below that, you'll see the options that you want to set to make this work, which is do not prefer a local cue point over other cue points, and messages may be sent to different cue points. So if you have those set, you'll get messages fanned out across all your partition queues, and the workload will be balanced, and it'll be much easier for each messaging engine to handle the load. And I think that's it, and we'll move on to the next section, which is scaling consumers, and Rich Montjoy will present that.
How do I scale consumers? Question number 4. Slide 23, please. Scaling consumers. When you deploy an MDB to a cluster, each cluster member will consume messages when there is a message engine running locally. If there is not a message engine running locally, then the MDB will not be active. As we can see in the graphic, the server on the right has no local ME, so the MDB is not actually running on that server. In version 7, as we'll see in a couple of slides, there is a new configuration option available to change this behavior. Slide 24, please. MDB activation. It is recommended to deploy your MDBs in separate application clusters. This allows all the MDBs in the application server to be activated and available to consume messages. The graphic here shows the MDBs in cluster B connecting to the MEs in cluster A to consume messages off the partitioned queues. Slide 25, please. B7 MDB activation. As I mentioned a few slides back, there is new functionality in WebSphere version 7 which avoids this extra configuration of deploying your MDBs in a separate cluster. The activation specification for the MDB contains a new property called always activate MDBs in all servers. With this enabled, as the graphic demonstrates, MDBs that have no message engines running locally will still be activated and consumed from the other cluster members with active MEs. It is considered a best practice to either deploy your MDBs in their own application cluster or use the V7 functionality discussed here to allow the MDBs to be active on all servers in the cluster. Slide 26, please. Message visibility, sometimes referred to as message gathering. In WebSphere V7, there is a setting on the JMS queue point that allows MDBs to consume from all partitions of a queue point at once. With this enabled, MDBs are able to not only get from local MEs, but from remote MEs as well. As we have mentioned previously, it is strongly recommended to avoid using remote guests, so it is considered a best practice to leave this set to only messages on a single queue point are visible. Slide 27, please. MDB concurrency. The ability to control the number of MDBs running in parallel is done via the maximum concurrent MDB invocations per endpoint setting on the activation specification. When you're doing your load testing, you may notice your MDBs are having trouble keeping up with producers, and messages may be building up on the queue point associated with the MDB. If so, then you want to look at the MDB concurrency settings on the activation spec. The default value is 10, and the information center suggests 40 is a good value to start your testing on high-volume systems. Worth mentioning, if strict message ordering is a must, then this value should be set to 1. In version 6, MDBs use the default thread pool. In version 7, MDBs now use the SIBJMSRA thread pool. You want to make sure the sum total of all your MDBs running concurrently is set to less than the MDB thread pool size to ensure you have an available thread to service the MDB. So the thread pool size needs to be able to accommodate all the maximum concurrency values on all the activation specs which the server has MDBs deployed. Justin Fries will handle question 5 on slide 28 now.
Question 5, how can I use core groups and preferred servers for scalability? Let's go to slide 29. A core group is a collection of resources that's managed by the High Availability Manager in WebSphere Application Server, often just called the HAA Manager. And each resource is associated with a policy that tells the HA manager how to control that type of resource. Now, messaging engines use a policy by default called the default SI bus policy. And this policy is what's called a one of N policy with no preferred servers. One of N means that if the HA manager has several choices, N choices, of where to start a messaging engine, it will choose one and only one to start the messaging engine. So the default messaging engine behavior, especially in a cluster, goes something like this. In each member of the cluster, the messaging engine will join the HA core group, which means that HA is controlling it. The HA manager will tell the messaging engine to start in one and only one server. And in the system out logs for the various messaging, for the system out log for the members of the cluster, you're going to see a message, CWSID0016I, which will appear every time a messaging engine changes state. So in all of the cluster members, you will see that message reporting a joined status, and in one member of the cluster, you will see a starting and hopefully a started status. Let's go to slide 30. There is an issue with the default SI bus policy in that in a cluster, no server is considered better or worse than any other. The load on that server doesn't figure into the choice at all. So if you have a cluster with multiple messaging engines, it's possible that the HA manager may attempt to start them all in the first server to come up. And you end up with a situation somewhat like the one shown below. Server 1 comes up first, and HA taps it on the shoulder to run the messaging engines. And server 2 and server 3 have a whole lot of nothing to do. And this doesn't take good advantage of your server setup, your clusters, or of the machines underlying them. Server 1 may have to burn a lot of CPU time while the other servers sit idle. So how can we avoid this? Let's go to slide 31. Custom policies. It is possible to define a custom policy for your messaging engines. Some of the features of a custom policy are, first, preferred servers, which you can set up on the right. You see the red arrow pointing to the link. You can choose which servers in a cluster your individual messaging engines will prefer to run in. And you can even restrict messaging engines to start only in the servers that they prefer. The preferred servers are in a list based on preference. The first thing in the list is the most preferred server. Second is the next preferred, and so forth. Another option available is the failback checkbox, which is outlined in red. When failback is selected, an engine will restart itself when a preferred server becomes available. When this occurs, you will see message CWSID0016I again, and this time the messaging engine will show a status of stopping member to indicate that it is failing back. A best practice, then, is to configure custom one-of-N policies for your messaging engines with different sets of preferred servers for each and to enable failback. And this will ensure an even distribution of your engines across the cluster and maximize the power, processing power of the cluster. Let's go to slide 32. It may strike you that that's a fair amount of work to have to do just to get your messaging engines to start evenly across the cluster. And in WebSphere Application Server version 7, there is now a configuration wizard that can help with this. When you add a cluster as a new member of a bus, a new wizard will run in the admin console, which enables you to choose what sort of messaging engines you want. Do you want just a high availability messaging engine, maybe one messaging engine that fails across the members of the cluster? Or do you want multiple messaging engines, scalability, for example, with high availability, as I've selected here? When you make your choice, you can go onto slide 33 and examine the results. And here we see now that based on the choice of scalability with high availability, that the wizard has set up custom policies for the four messaging engines in this cluster. The 000 messaging engine prefers member 1 and 2 in that order. 001 prefers cluster members 2 and 3. Engine number 2 prefers 3 and 4, and engine number 3 prefers 4 and 1. So they each have their own set of servers on which they would prefer to run. In this case, the wizard has set it such that it will only run in their preferred servers, and they will fail back if a more preferred server becomes available. Let's go on to slide 34. And I'll turn over to Andrew Whitfield.
Thank you. Question 6. What are the key WebSphere components impacting SI bus performance? And what are the PMI values that should be used first to check performance? Slide 35, please. Okay. There are various components within WebSphere and SI bus that can impact performance. One of the best and easiest ways to analyze this performance issue is to use the PMI statistics. The next couple of slides will go over some of the PMI statistics that are a good starting point for any performance analysis. Just to start with, PMI stands for the Performance Monitoring Infrastructure, and PMI can be monitored a number of ways. The first and easiest way is through the TPV, which is the Tivity Performance Viewer available in the WebSphere application admin console. There's a Perf servlet tool. There's also JMX, so a customer can write an application to actually get hold of these statistics, or you can use a third-party tool such as ITCAM. So moving to the first set of statistics, this comes from Message Processor. The messages consumed count and the messages produced count, these statistics are available for all five of the message persistent values: best effort non-persistent, reliable non-persistent, assured non-persistent, reliable persistent, and assured persistent. What these values can provide is basically a summary of what your system's doing in terms of the number of messages that are produced versus the number of messages that are consumed. If you're seeing that the production count is much higher than the consumed count, then it's fairly obvious that your producers are basically too fast for your consumers to keep up. In this situation, you might want to look at adding more NDBs or increasing the number of consumers via either the max concurrency count on an activation specification, or if the consumers are synchronously receiving messages, increasing the actual number of client connections. The next set of statistics is the aggregate message wait time and the local message wait time. The aggregate message wait time is how long has this message been in the bus. That means that the message could have been on a remote queue point, which we've already seen, or was on a bus link ready to be sent over. The local message wait time is how long this message has been on this actual queue point. Comparing these two statistics together, you'll be able to tell whether the messages are being stuck on remote queue points on different MEs within the bus, and is a good way to determine that actually you should make direct connections rather than using remote connections. The next two statistics are the available message count and the unavailable message count. The available message count indicates a message is available to be consumed, but currently is not in the process of being consumed. The unavailable message count is typically seen when the message is being consumed. If you see a high number of available message counts, it normally means your consumer, again, isn't keeping up with the amount of messages on there. If this number is very large, then it's highly likely that you'll hit the message high limit. And so it is a good indicator for knowing that there's an issue on the system before the actual high limit is reached. The next two is the local consumer count and the local producer count. These are simply the number of consumers that are attached directly, i.e. connected directly to that messaging engine, rather than through another messaging engine. This is a good statistic to look at if you want to know exactly how many consumers are currently attached and how many producers are currently attached, and then comparing that with the number of messages that are actually consumed and produced. If you can move to slide number 36, please. So the next set of statistics are the message store statistics. The message store handles both the data store and the file store, which is essentially the persisting of a message. One of the highest performance impacts that the SI bus can have is typically the overhead of persisting a message to either a database or the file store. The JDBC transaction timeout, which is the first statistic here,
indicates basically how long each JDBC transaction is taking the message for. So that's to insert data, to update data, to delete. If the values are high, then looking at JDBC driver, looking at the database, and analyzing maybe why these transactions are taking so long. The persistent dispatcher avoidance count and the spill dispatcher avoidance count are two counts that indicate how successful we are, how successful the messaging engine is in avoiding any database work. What that means is that if you're using reliable persistent, you could potentially put a message and then consume that message without the messaging engine actually getting to the point of persisting the message. This is normally a good thing. Persisting to the database is probably the most incentive thing that the message engine would do. So seeing a good avoidance count is normally a good thing. If this is low, then it normally assumes that your consumers aren't quick enough to actually consume the message before the message engine comes to persist the message asynchronously. The next two are the file store log space and the file store permanent object space. These are two counters that indicate how much space is left in the file store log. With a message engine, you can choose between either a data store, which is the database, or a file store, which is a log. These two statistics at the bottom of the slide are for the file store. If you see the numbers for the amount of space becoming low, then this potentially could be that there's too many messages in the system for the configured log size. So either messages should be consumed or the log file size should be increased based off what the expected throughput is. If you go to slide number 37, please. So moving away from actual SI bus statistics, we can move into some of the other WAS components. First being the J2C or the JCA connection PMI stats. These control basically how your application connects or creates connections, and those connections are pulled within the system. It's used mainly for the producing applications, but is also used by the MDBs and the resource adapters. The first statistic is the managed connection count. This simply is the number of managed connections that have been used on the system. This should be in comparison to what you set your connection pool to be. So if you set the connection pool to be maximum of 10, you would want the number of maximum managed connections to be within this limit. The free pool size and the pool size are two indicators of the pool size that's been used. If the free pool size is getting low, i.e. there aren't that many free connections available in the pool, then you might want to look at increasing the pool size, the maximum number of connections in the pool size. The next set of two statistics are the wait time and use time. These are specifically about those connections. The wait time is how long has an application waited to obtain a free connection from the pool. If that wait time is excessive, then you might again want to look at increasing the number of connections in the pool. There could also be potentially other reasons why the connections aren't being freed up from the pool. These could be transaction timeouts or external services such as databases or web services that maybe aren't replying or returning as quickly as expected, which has the knock-on effect of connections being unavailable to the application on other threads. The use time, again, is how long has that connection been used. That's not just necessarily when a connection obtains it, when an application contains an application connection and uses it, but also be the transaction that application is running within. If we can move to slide 38, please. So the next WAS component is the EJB statistics. These are good for when you have a number of message-driven beams in your system and you want to see what the performance of those MDBs are. The first statistic we have is message count. This indicates how many messages this MDB has consumed. This is a good indicator of knowing, okay, which server within my cluster is accepting or processing the largest number of messages. Ideally, you would want a nice spread of messages. So within your cluster, if you have five servers, you would want all five servers to be processing roughly around the same amount of messages. There might be, if you see one server with a particularly low number, that might be an indication that there's something on that server that is using the CPU or some other process is basically blocking the WebSphere process from running as compared to the other servers within the cluster. The method level call count is the number of times a method on the MDB is being called. Typically, from a customer point of view, you only have the on message method, but there are some other EJB methods, such as the create call, pre-invoke, and post-invoke that can be called. These are a good indicator for when potentially an MDB has been assigned to drive a message, but actually the on message hasn't been driven for various different reasons. So if the method level call count doesn't correspond to the message count, then there's normally an indication that the SI bus message engine has decided that actually this MDB shouldn't be driven with this message. The last statistic we have here is the message backout count. That is simply how many messages have actually failed. Typically, that's within the on message method. So if you throw an exception or the application throws an exception with an on message, it also indicates when a transaction has timed out, which isn't necessarily when the on message has failed. So this could be a transaction timeout or maybe a failure to connect to the message engine after the MDB is finished but before the transaction is completed. Move to slide 39, please. And I think I'll pass over to Joseph for the question and answer session.
Thank you to our panel of experts for answering the pre-submitted questions. At this point in time, Michelle, we would like to open the lines for live Q&A period.
At this time, we have no one queued up with a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. We do have a question here coming in through the web conference, so I am going to announce the question verbally over to our panel of experts. So the question is, I have a question regarding the messaging engine. We have two application server clusters and two ME clusters. We deploy different applications to these clusters. Is there a way I can restrict what messaging engine cluster to be used by the application cluster?
In simplest terms, going back to the section in the presentation that Belinda provided for us, you can use targeting to select which cluster, for example, or which specific messaging engine your application connects to.
Thank you. And then there is a follow-up to this question. And his question is the messaging engine on different cluster intelligent enough to redirect it to the correct ME?
Joseph, if they're talking about, it sounds like their customer is asking about remote put and bootstrapping, the answer is yes. If you connect to one messaging engine and the queue that you want to send a message to is on a different messaging engine and they're in the same cluster, then yes, it'll find the remote queue and send it there. Actually, they only need to be in the same bus, actually.
And to add to that, Ty, if the connection is connected to a bootstrap server that's in one cluster and the messaging engines are in a different cluster, then the bootstrap server will also redirect the initial connection that's made by the application.
Thank you. And once again, Michelle, can we open the lines up one more time just in case we have any other questions coming in from our participants?
Mr. Yagoyevich, sitting with Yaresh Narayana.
Yes, it's Anas Yagoyevich. Question is regarding fault tolerance of SAP in case of WebSphere process server extended golden topology. It's when we have multiple ME clusters and multiple WPS clusters. What happens when one of the ME servers goes down or being restarted? Do the consumers from the WPS cluster being automatically redirected to the running servers? Or that's actually my question. What happens?
Okay. Let me see if I can repeat your question. In a WPS environment where you have multiple clusters, you want to know what happens if one of the MEs goes down and whether your consumers will be able to still consume. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, I can answer this one. Basically, the connection that the application will have will be closed either Either it was notified by the application server that it's closed in the event that the application server with the message engine closed down in a controlled way. If the application server that has the message engine failed, it lost power, for example, and shut down unexpected, then the application server with the application will get an indication that the connection has died, will close that connection, and a new connection will be made to the message engine that's failed over to the next server. So the answer is that the application will be fault tolerant, and assuming that both servers within that message engine cluster, at least one of those is running, then you should be able to make a connection to the message engine.
Is there any way to expedite the process of switching to the running ME servers?
There are various system properties regarding heart beating, etc., that can be tuned. I believe there's some information in the information center about that. Basically, it's for the application server to tell when the ME server has gone down and be able to connect to the next one. There are various different issues that can occur depending on how fault tolerant the actual network is. In most cases, it should happen automatically underneath the covers.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Justin. If I could just add one thing to that. There is a rare circumstance in which a messaging engine server can lose connection to a database if you're using a data store for your messages. And then the other server has trouble starting the messaging engine because the database still thinks the original engine instance is connected. And last year, Ty Schrake, who's on this call, he actually gave a full WebSphere Report Technical Exchange presentation about this type of problem. And there are recommendations there for how to tune TCP/IP Keep Alive and how to make sure your databases are using it, so that if one messaging engine loses its database connection, the database will clean up and the messaging engine can restart in another server in a timely fashion. So if you go to the WSTE site and search on Ty Schrake, you will find his presentation from last year.
Thank you very much. That's actually exactly the issue that we had.
Okay.
That will come from Purna Karama. Your line is open.
My question is just I want to add to the previous question. As I asked earlier, if the message goes to a different cluster, like we have two application clusters and two messaging clusters, and we have different applications on different application clusters. So if a particular message goes to a wrong messaging cluster due to load, the other messaging cluster, is it capable enough to redirect it to a proper cluster?
Let me see if I have the question right. You've got two application clusters and two message engine clusters, mm-hmm. And if your application fails for some reason to send it to one cluster, will it be redirected to the other? Is that your question?
No, it is getting redirected because of the load. The message is getting redirected to the different cluster. But my question is, if it's redirected to the different cluster, will the messaging engine on the different cluster will be able to communicate to the proper destination, proper consumer?
So you're saying that the initial connection by the application is being redirected to a different cluster than the one that localizes the destination?
Mm-hmm.
Then in that case, yes, it would be the remote put that Muhammad described earlier. Mm-hmm. It would, if it's in the same bus, that is, it would create a remote cue point, and when the messaging engines that localize the destination are available, then the message would be forwarded. And for putting applications, that's certainly a fine thing to do. It insulates your producing application from a particular messaging engine being down. If you're talking about consuming applications, there we would recommend avoiding that sort of thing and ensuring that your connection is directly to a messaging engine that localizes the destination.
Okay, but the application cluster and messaging cluster are tied up, and if the message went to a different cluster, it won't have that application on the local application cluster. So, I mean, would there be any breakages or outages there?
Could you repeat the question, please?
If since the applications are not distributed evenly, and we have some applications on one application cluster and other applications on a different cluster, since the message went to a different messaging cluster which doesn't have that particular application in its application cluster. So,
but it does have a localized queue point with the same name?
I don't think so. So it's not there.
So it will only connect to a messaging engine that's in the bus that is in the same bus. So if you are specifying your target, then that application will only be able to use connections to the message engines that you specify.
Okay.
So the point there would be that you don't want to have that application connecting to the other bus in any way, so you
yeah.
want to control which messaging engines
yep.
can,
yep.
in fact, connect to.
Yep. Thank you.
You're welcome.
At this time, we have no one else in the queue with a question.
Thank you, Marshall, and thank you to our panel of experts for answering the questions in the Q&A period. At this point in time, I would like to move on to slide number 41 and pass the presentation over to Ty for a summary of today's session.
Thank you, Joseph. In summary, this presentation covered several important SIB scalability concepts and techniques. In particular, it discussed the advantages of remote put and advise its use whenever possible. On the other hand, we strongly advise not using remote get for a number of reasons that we've seen in the presentation. We also discuss activation spec configuration and techniques, targeting consumers to the right messaging engines. Talked about scaling producer applications, which includes the use of partition queues and workload management. We talked about handling large volumes of messages, which goes to workload management. Talked about scaling consumer applications, message-driven beans. We talked about managing messaging engine core group policies so that you can define where your messaging engines run, which servers they run on. And lastly, we talked about PMI statistics for identifying SIB performance problems, or if you just have questions about how your system is performing, we covered a number of statistics that you can look at to give you some insight into that. And we hope this information and the open mic discussion, which followed, will help you scale your SIB environments. And I want to thank everybody for joining us today.
Thank you, Ty, for a great summary. At this point in time, we will conclude the Ask the Expert session.